Starfighter is ready for launch.
Gunstar in position. All right. Welcome to the Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theater. Here tonight, we are presented a very special movie, and this is part two of The Last Starfighter. Joining me tonight is my Gunstar gunner, or navigator, I should say, Norman C. Lau. Norman, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm so excited, Davis, to do this with you. We have been talking about this for actually quite a while now. And that's the great thing about the Couch Potato Theater format. We get a chance to actually dive in a deep way, both in a retrospective and in commentary, to talk about a film that is very near and dear to us. So I think that the audience is going to have a fantastic time when they go through this journey with us and join us on The Last Starfighter commentary. I'm excited. And does that mean I'm Grig? I'm the old man?
Oh, I think I would be Grig, wouldn't you? Because you would be Alex, right?
Well, you threw me a navigator, so I'm all the way up there instead of down here. So I'll take any position as long as it's in a Gunstar.
Absolutely. The Gunstar is an amazing vehicle. Yeah. I will have to say to that. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do tonight is talk about The Last Starfighter, and we're going to watch the movie. So if you have never watched The Last Starfighter, this is your time to watch it, because you get a special presentation commentary of Norm and myself talking about the love of this movie and how much we have had the time enjoying this movie, so to speak. So if you have a Blu-ray, Netflix, DVD, Xbox One, PS4, whatever you have, we are at the main title screen, and we are going to do a countdown of starting at 5 and start the movie. So, Norm, are you ready to go?
I'm ready. And I just, for the audience's sake, I am watching the iTunes version of it with my subtitles on. And I have a little bit of the sound turned up so that I can make sure that I'm doing a commentary on the fantastic musical cues of Craig Safin's incredible score, because there's a lot of emotion tied up with that. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the commentary. But yes, I am using the iTunes format, but with Blu-ray or however you're watching it, make sure that you are set to 00.00.00 so that you are completely synced up with us by the time Davis says play.
All right. So I am actually on an Xbox One playing the Blu-ray player, and I am about to start the countdown. Norm, are you ready?
I am ready. My Xenon Mist heads-up display is on. Proton particles on. And I'm not going to touch the Death Blossom panel until later on in the podcast, if necessary. And make sure that all the listeners are within Death podcast range.
Absolutely. So I guess it's time to head to Rylos, my boy.
Let's do it.
All right. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play.
I'm so excited.
This is just such a great movie. When's the last time you've seen the movie?
I watch it at least once, maybe twice a year. And
okay,
this is, I mean, we're going all the way back to 1984. So the Universal title screen that came up, that's a classic. And sometimes when you re-release movies, you get to see that really new brand spanking shiny Universal logo, but not in this case. We get to see a very classic logo. And we jump right into the Craig Safin scene. Oh, God, I love it so much. Lorimar is also a touchstone back into the 80s.
Yes, that's true. And it is so amazing to know that, you know, Universal did this movie. And even to this day, Steven Spielberg has tried to do this movie and no dice. He can't get the rights to it.
We're seeing a little bit here in the credit sequence of a little bit of homage to Superman the movie, with some of these credits kind of doing that whoosh kind of fade effect. We talked about the cast and how important each individual casting choice was, especially Robert Preston as Centauri to this movie. I can't say enough about this score. I think this score is right up there with some of the great composers. I mean, we're talking about the John Williams and the James Horners and the Howard Shores, even the Michael Giacchinos. I think that Craig Safin, at least in this particular score for this movie, really sets the tone of that innocent heroism that is threaded throughout the course of this. I love it so much. And you brought this up in the retrospective. The Entrada 2-disc set is the way to go.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, when you think about how long ago that this movie was played, and still how well it holds up to, you know, 2016. I mean, this is just a fun movie to actually watch. And you're absolutely correct with the soundtrack. He actually wanted to do something has of Star Wars, and he wanted to make it bigger. He wanted to make it so grandiose. He wanted to have a world building sequence, so to speak.
Now, to credit of Jonathan Battelle's script, he was of the arcade genre. He used to stop by after work to his local arcade and just relax and blow off steam and just get into his element. That's why this movie, and we said this in the earlier retrospective of Starfighter Part 1, why it's so heavily steeped in using this singular plot device, the arcade version of Starfighter, as the focal point, because that's who he was. Writers usually tend to write successfully on what they know. That's the old quote-unquote Hollywood saying, you write what you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, you know, you're wandering right now. You're wandering into a desert. You don't know what's going on. And you finally see the trailer park.
I think the great thing about this opening sequence is that you're really setting the stage for a certain mediocrity that our protagonist needs to move past. So many people that live in Starlight, Starbright, they're okay. They have relegated themselves to this existence, you know, like... I'm sorry, sometimes I gotta laugh in this commentary because it's just so unbelievably perfect. I call this the Shire sequence or like the Beauty and the Beast sequence, you know, where, you know, there's something like much more than this provincial life, because that's kind of what's happening right now. It's almost very musically themed. There's this really great wide and long pan shot of who the characters are and the central players. You know, you have Clara, you have Otis, you have Granny, you have Maggie. And now you're going to be introduced soon into the Rogan family. You're going to have Alex's mom, Lewis, the brother. I shouldn't jump forward because this is I should be commenting on what I'm seeing, but I can't help myself.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a normal everyday life. I mean...
Just watch, I'm going to make Maggie my wife. But that's kind of, you know, there's a very kind of like a musical theatricality going. You could, and I think they have made The Last Starfighter into a musical, have they not?
You know what? I think they have. Yeah. I'm almost positive. But I don't remember when it was, though.
It does have that certain quality to about it. And what I love about the scene here is now you're setting up the breadth and the layout of what this existence is, who these people are, and you're jumping right into this singular moment where you see our hero, I should say quote unquote our hero, we don't know he's a hero yet, but our protagonist Alex Rogan and what he does to escape, even for that smallest moment, from this existence, you know, this mediocrity. And in some way, I think that we are looking at what's called, maybe arguably so, a predestination or something that has, this always should be for him. I don't know. It's I don't want to get too metaphysical about it, but I just love that how they're layering all these characters and slotting them in where they should be. Maggie is always trying to just live in the present moment. And Alex is, like I said before, in the retrospective, he's always kind of looking away at something that's grander and not as in the present moment. But maybe that's what makes them such a great couple. Opposites attract.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounded like he was focused on where he wants to be instead of where he is right now.
Can you do that in the Yoda voice?
Yes. He's never his mind on where he was. What he was doing.
He was doing.
Now, I just want to throw a little small bit of casting trivia here, but in the truck that, you know, who you're looking at right now. And do you remember the TV series V?
Yes, I do.
That was Brian. That was the alien who had a relationship with a human female, Robin, and they had the alien baby.
Oh,
yeah.
I couldn't remember that. That is too cool.
I also call him William Zabka Light because he was, if you couldn't get William Zabka Johnny from Karate Kid, you would get this actor. I don't remember his name offhand, but you got this actor. So
I don't know his name either.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But now you're getting, like, just to get back on the commentary, you're kind of getting Alex Lott in life. He's right about to have probably the height of his summer, going to the beach. He's looking at his mail for his college acceptance because he doesn't want to stay here. He doesn't want to relegate his life to this, whatever this is, which is okay for some people, but it's not okay for him. And now his mom, who has to work double shifts, can't help out at the trailer park. So the interesting thing is that Alex is the fixer. He's the fixer personality. He wants to make sure that everyone is okay. He said, no, go ahead, Maggie. If you go off and have a good time, you're okay. If I can fix what's happening in the trailer park to help my mom out, they're okay. But the only person so far that isn't okay is Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you almost think he's the type of protagonist character that he wants to make everyone happy except himself.
But why do you think that is? Where in the story are we where he accepts that this is his lot in life?
I have to wonder. I mean, just because he's willing to do that, you know, he could have gone with them, but he chose to stay behind. You almost have to wonder if it was just because of his upbringing that he just said, you know what, I need to do the right thing and do it.
Is this the quality that later on adds to the overall, I guess the overall part of what makes him a starfighter, or what will make him a starfighter, the necessity to serve everybody?
I think so, because you have to have that, like, almost like a serving leader attitude where, you know, you're not focused on yourself, but you're more focused on everyone else around you.
Now,
and
I'm sorry, but tell me that this isn't Luke's or Alex's twin son's moment on Tatooine. Tell me it's not that scene.
Oh, I think it is. I have to look at it because he's wondering what else is there.
Exactly.
And you know what? How many other people growing up in the 1980s thought that same thing?
I don't think that's, like, mutually exclusive to, you know, to a certain generation. I think that is something that's at the heart of a dreamer, the heart of somebody who wants to do better than where he is. And of course, now, where he is safe, where he finds his comfort zone, is here, back at the Starfighter game. Oh my God, why didn't they make this a stand-up game in arcades? Really?
That would have been an awesome game. You know that?
It's the perfect tie-in. I mean, it literally is the perfect tie-in. It's kind of like they made Pixels, right? And they had all these different three-dimensionalized characters, Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, you know, all the Space Invaders and stuff. And they made that, you know, it's an honor to, you know, the old Namco games of the arcades. So why wouldn't they do that here? I don't know. Now, I think aside from Alex and aside from some of the other characters, Otis is my favorite character in this movie.
Tell us why.
Because what I like about Otis is that I think in very many ways, there are three mentors in this movie. And I'm not going to jump the gun, but I'm going to say that Otis is the first mentor. And the reason why I say that is because he makes Alex take a look at where he is and what he is doing and what matters most. He's like, you know what? You have a good thing going. And enough of this pity party. You know, it's like, oh, no, you never have a good time. You know, it's like, it's always about you and what never goes right for you. You're not counting the blessings that you have. And I think that's what's really cool about Otis is Otis just says, look, you have a beautiful, understanding girlfriend. You know, you have the potential to do whatever you want. And this look, oh my God, I love that look. He's like, why don't you see what's in front of you, right?
Exactly. I mean, you have to wonder if it was Otis trying to be almost like a moral anchor to him, to remember to be thankful for what he has, and eventually his shot will come.
I had this sneaky feeling at one point in time that Otis was almost kind of, he was keeping tabs on Alex in some way. In another universe, or maybe in a rewrite of maybe the modern Starfighter, that Otis, they always had kind of like the Green Lanterns, they always had a certain way of keeping tabs on potential Lanterns, like Guy Gardner or
John Stewart.
John Stewart, yeah. Maybe there were like three or four possible candidates aside from Alex. It's just that Alex was able to unlock his potential first. And speaking of that, when I was watching this again, Alex, in this scene, like right here, he's about ready to break the highest score that's ever been set on this particular Starfighter console. And in my interpretation, when he was talking to Maggie, he was jealous that Maggie was hanging out with Blake. He wanted to defend her honor. He wanted to make sure that she was protected. And look what happened. He subconsciously started to crush the Starfighter game because he wanted to protect her. That was going on in his brain.
Do you think that was a little bit of what's to come?
You tell me.
You know, he instinctively said, you know, he already knows exactly what to do, and it's just instincts taking over.
I think that what we're going to see a lot in this movie is that when Alex is at his best, he wants to make sure that he's defending the people that he loves. And I think that's obviously, like Joseph Campbell writes in a lot of his, the mythology of a hero, that's one of the hero's trials, is that what is he willing to sacrifice for the people that he's supposed to defend? Alex always does his best work in Starfighter when it matters most, when he's like, these are the people that I love. These are the people that I'm supposed to protect. In some way, he's channeling all of that talent at this moment. And what I love about this scene in particular, the whole Shire, even though they don't understand what's happening, like, what's a command ship? I love that. Like Clara says, what's a command ship? This is probably one of the greatest moments that this trailer park will ever experience together as a people. Ever.
Absolutely.
And it's so charming. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, even just look at it right now. I mean, he's cool under pressure. Everyone is encouraging him, you know, to keep going. And it's like he's blocked them all out. It's like he knows what he has to do, and he's doing it. Mm-hmm. And he's going after that command ship.
What do you think of Lance Guest in this role? Like, what is he bringing to you on screen?
He's bringing to me what would be a person who, you know, because this could have been a guy or a girl, you know, I think it's just what we all want in life, you know, to be one, to be recognized, to be that person who has the respect of others, and, you know, to know that there is more to this life. I mean, that's what I'm seeing right now. I mean, he's celebrating with his entire extended family, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's just so cool to be able to see that family is so happy for him, even though half of them are probably like, what in God's name is happening? But, you know, they're all happy for him.
Local boy makes good, right?
Yeah. You know, this was always one of the cool things, the starlight, star bright, and you just see Alex and Maggie outside, and you just see this plethora of stars.
There are certain movies where you see a lead actor and a lead actress. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think one of the most charming things about The Last Starfighter is that Lance Guest and Catherine Mary Stewart had immediate chemistry from the very get-go. It's you can believe that they are these characters.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's even what they said on, I think it was IMDb, is those two had such great chemistry that they knew they had to be together.
Mm-hmm. I think that in the 80s, you know, you had movies like, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Karate Kid, Top Gun to a certain extent, Pretty in Pink, all of the John Hughes movies, and there's always this signature guy and signature girl. And sometimes it worked, like, say, in 16 Candles, you know, Molly Ringwald was the signature girl. The Breakfast Club was probably ostensibly a different movie, but, you know, everyone paired off kind of like even Anthony Michael Hall, you know, he paired off with his essay. But in this movie, I think that the chemistry between those two is so honest that everything that Alex chooses to do later on in the movie, you understand that it is truly because he wants to make sure that she's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at how they're interacting with each other, he wants the best for her and he wants her, you know, to get out of the trailer park. He wants to do something more to his life and he wants her by his side no matter what.
It's funny, in the 1980s, you know, you have a lot of this kind of motif where you want to further yourself, to pull yourself out of like the smaller situation. Footloose, you know, he wants, you know, Kevin Bacon's, you know, Ren, he wants to pull himself out of this small town existence and do something greater. In Ferris Bueller, you know, he wants to do something just a grander and larger with his life, even though it's not necessarily something like going out and fighting a galactic empire, but he just wants to do something bigger. Everyone wants to do something. They're coming from something small. I'm not saying small as in petty. I'm saying small as in just like the scope of their universe to something great, to something that's momentum, that's monumental, that something has great impact in their lives, and just something that inspires people to do something a little bit more fun and just to get out of their own skin. That's something that I feel very fundamental about this movie, is that there's something, and this is the trigger moment of the movie. This is what I want to call the lightsaber moment. And I apologize to the listeners if I'm like making too many like references to Star Wars, but it really is. This is a Star Wars for a new generation. There is a scene here that's where Alex is like, you know, his world is crumbling on him. His future, much like Luke's when he had to go to Tashi Station to pick up power converters, it's not what he wants. And I love when Alex looks at the machine. He's like, he hears a very familiar voice. And I'm glad that they actually used Robert Preston's voice as the voice for the machine. What do you think there, Davis?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you had this when you were about 17, 18 years old and you realized that you couldn't go to college or you couldn't go to one college that you wanted to go to and how disappointed you were. And you have to wonder, say, what else am I going to do? And, you know, he doesn't want to go to City College. And then he starts to hear this voice and he's like wondering, well, what's going on? What can I do now? Because he, like you said, in a Star Wars sense, he's at that point of going, I don't know what to do more with my life. And right now hearing Robert Preston's voice, of course, you're just wondering, oh, this is weird.
Well, because you're seeing what happened. He knows that voice. He's played Starfighter, I don't know how many times, but he knows that voice. And now he's hearing that voice live. That's got to be unnerving.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about it. How would you want it if all of a sudden you heard a video game voice and you hear it? It's like hearing your own voice actor and your favorite voice actor. And you're going, whoa, wait a minute. This is very surreal right now.
Robert Preston. Folks, when you're watching this and you're listening to this commentary, I just have to pause and take a moment and just respect the screen time that we're having with Robert Preston right now. Oh my God. I can't even, right?
Oh, I mean, Centauri, when you first meet him, he's like, I'm not here to buy cigarettes or bubblegum, my boy. Mm-hmm. You know, you almost wonder if he's going to break out in a song and dance at this moment.
But that's what I mean with that whole musical thing. You know, that's the meme. But listen to his slick car salesman attitude. You're the best, my boy. The best. Best I've ever seen. You know,
step into my office.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. He's so good.
Who would you want to have be Centauri now?
You know,
if we did a remake,
we had a really good conversation about this in the retrospective. And I think you brought this up. I think that we were talking about possibly Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is exactly who I picture in my head right now is Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. Cause Kevin Spacey, he had that movie where he did the, you know, the life story of James Darren. I think it was by the, Somewhere Beyond the Sea or Beyond the Sea. And that was his signature song. And Robert Preston is a song and dance man. You know, he was the music man. I mean, I think he will always be known as the music man for aside from any other role that he's ever done and how brilliantly he would always do it. He is the music man. So I think that you needed that kind of theatricality for this particular role. And it's not uncommon for, say, actors who have had a certain level of status, like your Alec Guinness or like your Peter Cushing in Star Wars, to have been cast in movies like this at the end of their career. Now, respectively saying that this was Robert Preston's last role, it was probably, in many ways, his most memorable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many other people remember Music Man? I mean, unless they're really big into musicals or anything, they may not. And then when they see, you know, they see him in The Last Starfighter, and then they see the Music Man, they're like, wait a minute, these two are one and the same.
I got to get that license plate, Rylos.
Rylos, okay. My boy.
So here's where we start now, the transitioning between live action, because everything so far from the very beginning to now has been live action. And now you're entering the CGI, the very earliest CGI component in this movie. And it's starting to take you in this different direction. What did you think about seeing this very first CGI when you saw it the first time?
When I saw it the first time, I just thought it was cool. I mean, just to see a flying car, because how many times you ever wanted to have a flying car that actually went into space as well?
And I mean, that was unnerving.
Yeah. Now, I know we've already passed this scene, but what did you think of the mysterious person that got out of the car? What was your first reaction to that?
Hard to say, because, you know, all of a sudden you got electrocuted and, you know, smacking. It just happened. And you don't really kind of pay attention to it because you're really kind of focusing on Robert Preston's character. It was a very interesting bait and switch that was going on with your focus at the time, with where it's very sleight of handish, if you will, as a magician. Now you saw the star field at the very beginning of the credits. Now you're just whoosh, you know, now you know that you're going into something otherworldly. Earlier on, say in, like, you know, Star Trek II, that was in 1982, the Wrath of Khan, you know, you've seen warp effects, you've seen hyperspace effects. This is something new. You know that when you're encountering something of this kind of an effect or of magnitude, you know that you're going elsewhere for sure.
Yeah, it had a little bit of effect of hyperspace plus warp drive, just a little bit of amalgamation of everything you've seen, you know. Even that bit of the old Buck Rogers TV show when they went through mm-hmm. their Stargates. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that or
oh,
not.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. Pritana. There's something really charming when it comes to doing linguistics in movies, and I really like the fact that they attempted this in Starfighter. Now, what you're seeing now, folks, is you're seeing Central Star League Command, and it's just, God, it's so gorgeous. Even now, like, I have been, we as a generation have been spoiled to death by some of the best visual effects that have been produced by mankind. But if they don't tell you and inform you about the story and work seamlessly to help you through that narrative, what are they really aside from eye candy?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you first see it, you're just going, what is this rock formation that you see? And then all of a sudden, you just see this grandiose command center.
And there's the logo, bro. There's my logo. The logo of Star League Command.
Do you think he realizes he's no longer anywhere near Earth?
I think that Lance Guest does a really good job of just having this whole kind of, I'm unsettled. Like, okay, so remember, he's played Starfighter many times. He understands certain visual cues. But I think that's one of the things about the 1980s is that you always thrust that your protagonist or your heroes into situations that they just kind of roll with in a way. Like, they're not as cynical, say, as your protagonists of movies today. You know, he's like he said, there's a perfectly logical explanation for all of this. He's not sure what's going on, but he's not afraid either.
No, he's not. And did you? I love the fact that they were all speaking in an alien accent, and then they give him something, and he can understand everything they're saying.
But what I like about that is that you're attempting at least to create, to do world building, you know, quote unquote world building in a sense, where you're on Rylos, the Rylans have their language, Star Command has their visual aesthetic. You know, this is, you know, this is very akin to we're processing you as a soldier.
Yeah. And even like this little scene right here, when he's going through the processing, doesn't it remind you a little bit of Empire Strikes Back?
Oh, totally. You know, it's, yeah, totally. But now here's Centauri. You're like, okay, what happened to the stranger with the great fedora? And all of a sudden you think that he's doing something great, but I think that currency is something that we all recognize no matter like what generation we're in, whether it's the 1980s or watching the Ferengi like trade gold, press platinum, or now, you know. And look at this guy having his lunch. He's like, here's your uniform. I'm done. I'm going to go back to my sandwich. Everything's so matter of fact right now for everybody except for Alex.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everyone knows what they're doing. And Alex is just going around going, what is happening here? It's like everyone else is like a normal day at work. And then today it's Alex is going, what?
Now, who didn't? I mean, not to say that everybody didn't, you know, did do this, but Lewis is, he's the analog for the very mischievous brother.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and Maggie and Pigtails.
Indeed.
Very Marianne. She's obviously trending more Marianne than Ginger right now. Look, she's even wearing plaid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And she is adorable for sure.
Now, we all know that something happened between Alex and the mysterious stranger in the car. And we're not exactly sure. Obviously, we know that Alex is on Rylos because we've been spending all that time with him. So what's going on here?
Who is this person in Alex's bed?
Exactly.
And then you find out who it is.
That's pretty interesting.
It is very
Westworldy.
So what did you think of the command center when you first saw it?
It's hard not to draw parallels to certain visual aesthetics that were set by the production designs for Star Wars or Star Trek. What I did like about this is that it felt like it was trying to be its own unique visual language. But at the same time, I mean, these computers, you can only do so much with a certain level of budget and with a certain level of production quality. I think that the uniforms are great. I think that all, you can see the Starfighter logos on all of these uniforms. I think they're trying to be very unique. I think that for the budget that it had, it was very ambitious and it was trying to be its own thing. Oh my God. Ladies and gentlemen, that is what's called Starship porn.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's even thinking right now, I have got to be dreaming about this. I mean, seeing a Gunstar just moving across and you're going, wait, I was just playing this video game.
Bays of Gunstars. But I think Alex is a smart guy, obviously. You know, he's very ambitious, he's a smart guy. What's happening is not lost on him.
No, not at all. And he finally sees, oh, you speak English. All right, then. So what did you think of, all right, you see the Rylolians or Rylotians?
Rylans.
Rylans, that's it. Did you see any of them as starfighters?
Well, the great thing is about like what you're seeing right now is you're seeing a combination of starfighters or starfighters that were chosen by Star League Command, and I guess it would be like the multi-xeno relations that they have with all of these different alien species, because it's kind of like the Federation, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think General Dodonna is about to speak to everybody.
I was going
to
say the exact same thing. Oh my God, that's awesome, because that is Jan Dodonna, right?
Yeah, exactly. When I looked at him, I was like, wait a minute. What's he doing here?
I'm making a joke of it. Is that the actual actor who played Jan Dodonna?
You know what? I don't know.
Sure looks like
I've never looked it up or anything.
But see, look, all these multicultural species, and I think the prosthetic design that Ron Cobb is doing here, because Ron Cobb was in charge of the production design and the aesthetics. What's really neat about seeing this is that you're seeing, at least I know they're bipedal, and that's kind of like a convention for most science fiction, but you're seeing why the Star League exists.
Exactly. And, you know, even what do you see? What, 12 people? So you see like just a whole squad.
Well, remember, in these 12,
it's a two-seater.
Exactly. So you have navigators and gunners. So you're looking at 6 total gun stars, maybe 8.
And you notice the chair in front of Alex is empty.
Exactly. So we would have to assume that in front to back, just like the way the gun star is laid out, you have gunner and navigator. But we're now Alex is starting to see, or at least hear or understand, you know, he's hearing things like the Kodan Armada, the Frontier, things that have been mentioned in that particular game. So he's
victory
like,
or death.
Yeah, this is real. This is a real thing that's happening.
And you don't have to wonder, that Gunstar that we saw moving earlier, mm-hmm. was Grig moving that Gunstar out of the hangar?
It's very well possible. It could have been like, well, we're going to start working on the, you know, something very specific for that. We'll get that later on in the commentary. But, Dan O'Harely.
We finally meet Grig for mm-hmm. the first time.
I love it. And you know what the great thing is about this is that he thought he was just some bumbling intruder. And all of a sudden, when he saw the rank in his uniform, the starfighter rank, instant cred.
That, he completely just changed his whole game. And it's like, greetings, starfighter.
Mm-hmm. I love that so much. He's like, what? Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to give up the opportunity to serve at the highest level of Star League?
And you know, what I thought was funny, Grig actually says, Earth is not a part of the Star League. It's not due for many years or however he said it. And you have to wonder going, okay, when, how do they know all about Earth? You know, are they watching it? Are they doing that? And, you know, his little comment to Centauri is just absolutely priceless.
Which
up
also
to your Excalibur tricks.
Which also means that Grig has, it's either he's been around for a while with the Star League and he has obviously way higher security clearance, quote unquote, than say most.
Yeah, you have to wonder also if he was, in my own headcanon, let's just say he's actually a higher ranking. And since he was in the hangar at the time, he's all that's left. It's, you know, he has to be the one that does it. You know, he could have been the actual inventor of the Death Blossom. And he's the one that was actually working on it. And he's stumbled and he becomes the navigator for the last starfighter.
The scene here where Robert Preston is being Robert Preston as Centauri is so good. It's all about the cell, right? It's all about this, the Excalibur tests. And what I love about that particular line of dialogue is that Excalibur was the moment when Arthur drew the sword and understood his destiny. We saw that the very same moment when Kenobi gave Luke his lightsaber and Luke turned it on. That is the quest. That is the icon that starts the quest. In this sense, it's this game. And what I love about Centauri is that Centauri, his motives are in the right place, but they're also very self-serving at the same time, which makes him such a really unique character.
And here we see Xur, finally.
Played by Norman Snow, the great Norman Snow. And great name, Norman, by the way.
And then we come to the revelation that Xur is the son of, is he the chancellor of the Star League or?
Or Jan Dodonna.
Jan Dodonna. Yeah.
But now you're starting to put together the names and the faces of basically for what Alex has known his entire life of playing Starfighter, just names in a video game. But now they've become a reality. Xur and the Codan Armada.
I mean, and even think about that. He says everything is scattered and you'll never be able to attack us. And you have to wonder, going, well, how did they actually get past the frontier? You know?
Well, there, you know, I think one of the great things about 80s movies, this being one of them in particular, I think there's a certain loss of innocence in storytelling nowadays where everything needs to be explained. Why does everything need to be explained? Why can't it just be?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know,
I mean, and you know, I think sometimes when I look at like some of these movies and I like to, as we call it, you know, sometimes putting a headcanon to it, you know, you just like just to know the backstory of certain things or, and I think that's what makes it such a great movie is because you want to know more about like the Star League. You want to know more about the Alliance. You want to just to know more about it. You know, you want to see other things going on. And I don't know, I guess this is what I've always just loved about it. You know, just imagining other things happening or, you know, even, you know, what happened at the end of this movie, you know?
Yeah. But at the same time though, it's like, I you know, I want to return us back to the present moment of what's happening with Alex. So Alex has been basically shanghaied by Centauri to join the Starfighter Star League, which he has obviously great talent at. And Alex has literally rejected that the opportunity, which Grig has found unbelievable to him, because obviously races, alien races of the Star League, they found that as the greatest sort of source of honor and pride. And he's like, nope, take me home. I don't want to be any part of this.
And, you know, I mean, it's at the same time, you know, he's all upset about it. But then people are finding out going, what did you do, Centauri?
Yeah.
Why are you going to this planet?
But this kind of like falls into that whole Tolkien-esque narrative of the humans, like, or at least the humans are kind of like the analog to the hobbits. They aren't supposed to be able to affect the destiny of what's happening in this significant way. No one expects it, you know? And that's why, like, you know, Earth, who would expect Earth to be in the Star League? They're not ready yet. So.
Yeah, that's exactly it right there. And here we see the frontier.
Oh, Commander Krill. Yeah. I'm not going to jump forward in that moment, but
no, but
if you take a look at Xur's uniform, it is literally the Imperial version of the Star League uniform.
Almost like a mirror, mirror.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's really weird to see the Rylans all have a bald head and then hair around the side or like a very high forehead. Even the women are like that too. It's just really cool.
Almost like the Minbari, you know, from
exactly.
Babylon 5. Yeah.
Well, you have to wonder if someone got the idea from that.
Well, around this time, I think that JMS was pitching Captain Power and that video game. Yeah, we're going to have to talk about that later on because that was both media and toy at the same time.
That was pretty ingenious for the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you saw that little hint of the Codan Armada, especially Commander Krill here saying that we will bide our time with this fool and we will allow him to get us access past the frontier and then we will be able to exact our plans on the rest of the universe. Because right now, that giant minefield of self-sustaining Stembolt satellites is preventing the Codan Armada from basically invading the Star League's universe.
And then now you see there's a hole in the frontier.
This was a precursor to something that I thought was terrifying and also amazing in Babylon 5 called the Mass Driver, where you're basically launching asteroids through space to be as projectiles instead of energy weapons that can be dissipated by shields.
Oh yes, that happened on the Narn home world, didn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's Shays of Missile Command. Oh my God. Everything's the 80s in this movie. So And look at that, the Starfighters right there. Ugh. Amazing.
Oh. So they're heading to the hangar for sure.
Davis, when you look at this, when you look at the graphics that are going on, I mean, aside from maybe some texturalizing and some lighting, seriously, those effects really aren't that far off.
No, they're not. And the funny thing about it is, I mean, it's not too far from how, if you remember Babylon 5, of course you do remember Babylon 5.
Of course.
But, I mean, that wasn't too far off from what those graphics were.
No. Nope.
So, I mean, even if they were to just update the special effects and they just did a makeover of that, just tweaked them up a little bit, I think it would still be an amazing movie.
But what you're seeing, though, on these readouts, especially, you know, with Commander, he's looking at, oh, there's this one. It has nothing to do with the effects that's selling the scene. It's the fact that the narrative is working that these projectiles are going to exact extreme, extreme amounts of damage on the base.
And then you just see everyone when the shields or the weapons collapse, you know what's about to happen.
Exactly. So whether it's today's kind of effects or 1984's effects, the narrative is the same and the emotion is the same. So that's why I want to get people past, you know, when they're watching this movie, get past the effects, because the effects are obviously, look at the license plate registration, 1984.
Yeah.
It is of a certain date. And remember, if you were there like we were in 84, when you were watching this, these were mind-blowing effects. Even 2 years prior to this, when you did Tron, those were mind-blowing effects.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, even a year after this, Back to the Future comes on.
Exactly. And this car, I mean, believe it, that wasn't lost on me that this was very DeLorean-esque.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, who wouldn't want to time travel in a DeLorean? Come on.
You're definitely looking at north of Santa Barbara, California, kind of highway land. That's total California, man. And the funny thing is that the Rylos license plate is done in the same kind of colors that a California license plate was at the time. Blue and gold.
Blue and gold. And what's it? What's just a regular white license plate now, right?
Yeah. I've always wanted to find this prop, the Camino Crystal prop.
Yeah.
History.
Who's Gilgoa?
He sells it so well. Ah, God bless you, Robert Preston. I don't think, yeah. I mean, yes, I would love to see, you know, certain actors, you know, like we talked about earlier on, like a Kevin Spacey play this role, but this one broke the mold.
Yeah, he did.
God bless
him. And did he drive on the wrong side of the road?
He did, but, you know, it's kind of like Doc Brown, like roads, you know, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Absolutely. So here we have Alex coming back to see Maggie.
He's coming back to where he, interestingly enough, has found his sense of purpose. This is his world. Strange sexual urges.
And he's wondering what's happened. What is going on?
Now, just to give all the listeners a little bit back up here, the beta unit scenes were only supposed to have been so long, but because they tested so well, he did so well at, and they were so well received in test audiences that they decided to extend some of these just to fit the narrative and to give Maggie a little bit more to chew on. But they were only supposed to have been like very brief.
Now think about this, Norm. How would you have felt if you'd have saw your own beta sleeping in your own bed?
I think that after what Alex went through, going to Rylos, seeing what he saw, coming back, and I don't think that anything would surprise me right now, even as weird as this looks.
So you think Alex is pretty much desensitized to everything, and he's like, all right, what else is next?
You know, if you were going to tell the narrative today, I think that we'd probably make a bigger deal of it. But like right now, Alex, yeah, like I said, he won the Starfighter game. He went to Rylos. He was shanghaied by Centauri. He went through the process of becoming a starfighter. He should have the translator device still on his plaid shirt. And now they're explaining what this... I think this was a brilliant part in the story. Like, okay, if Alex goes off and is a starfighter, what happens? What happens to his life here on Earth?
And now you also get a little bit of world building. Just have the beta unit explained, because all the other starfighters have a beta unit on their respective world.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of some Star Trek continuity, we've already seen Granny. We've seen Granny, and Granny was played... I'll have to get the credits later. But Granny was the Talosian keeper in the cage. The character right now that you're seeing looks like he's sporting a very cool, almost a Bajoran blaster, which is kind of weird. That's Mark. That's Mark Alamo, a very young Mark Alamo, who eventually will become later on Gul Dukat in both Deep Space Nine, and then he actually played a different Cardassian in The Next Generation. But yeah.
He played Gul Madred?
Madred? Was it?
Yeah. I think that's what it was. Madred or?
But now you're seeing that there is a certain reason why the beta units have taken the identity of their starfighter counterparts. And also, just as in terms of trivia, there was a scene that was cut out earlier on where Will Wheaton made an appearance as one of Lewis's friends. So now you had Granny. Was it Meg Wiley was her name?
Meg Wiley. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so you had Meg Wiley as Granny, and not just the Talosian in the cage. And then you had Lewis's friend, who was Will Wheaton, and now you have Mark Alamo, who is Gul Dukat. So you have lots of Star Trek paying forward here.
Oh, so he's got the crystal.
How do you feel about that Tonka toy reference, toy guy?
That was, you know, it's always so much fun, because if you look at the original Tonka toys, they were so sturdy. I mean, if you even had them today, they're going to hold up. I mean, that was always one of the cool things. They were made out of actual metal. You know, they were a tough truck.
I always loved it in toys when they kept saying like die cast metal, like it was like something like far superior than a normal toy, right? When you think that when this is obviously since Centauri made the Starfighter game, it was built on alien technology. So we're going to go there, you know, so that technology obviously has been able to out this Zandozan bounty hunter.
Is this when we find out it is a Zandozan, or is it a little bit later on?
I believe. And apologies to the listeners, because we know this movie so intimately well that we are jumping a little bit ahead. But yes, when I'm not going to say anything further. We'll find out. Yeah. But going back to the Starfighter game looks like an arcade cabinet game, feels like a human arcade cabinet game, was marketed and put into stores for Christmas as a human arcade cabinet game, but still was created by alien, possibly Rylan technology that had the ability to mete out alien species like this bounty hunter. I thought that was kind of neat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Almost like a divining rod. And there's the DeLorean. I mean,
Centauri.
Tell me that's not a Bajoran blaster. Tell me that's not a Bajoran blaster in his hand, which is totally ironic.
Oh, Centauri's a good shot.
Yeah, he is. Oh, just like Star Wars, somebody loses a hand. Now, one of the reasons why the beta unit sometimes looks a little odd is because Lance Guest himself was actually suffering some severe flu at the time when they filmed the beta unit scenes. I do believe that this is the script playing into Robert Preston's illness.
Yes, I had heard that. I had heard that when he, I think he was actually very sick during this time. I don't remember. Was it cancer during this time that he had, or
I think
was he going through cancer?
I do believe it was.
I want to say that. And so they put his, and which I think is pretty ingenious right there. Cause I think he, well, I don't want to spoil what's about to happen. So, yeah. So we're having Alex and the Beta and Centauri all talking, unbeknownst about what's about to happen. Oh,
yeah.
And so Centauri has...
Look at Centauri lay down that line of fire.
Oh, I know.
He completely stitched that guy.
And he says, just a scratch.
Yeah. There was a really clean shot of the Zandozan's blaster, though, and I have to believe that it was used elsewhere.
You know, you have to wonder if some stuff was actually borrowed other places.
I've seen props being used today. They actually had a Babylon 5 Star Fury pilot suit used in a modern TV show just recently. They're just assets.
Yeah. Oh yeah. If you look at Bossk from Empire Strikes Back, mm-hmm. His outfit was used in a Doctor Who episode.
That's why I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've made a pact here with Alex and the Beta unit. Alex is going to rejoin Star League. This is breaking my heart, man, seeing this.
Oh yeah.
You know. There's Nick Castle just does a great job at explaining the narrative in very profound but very subtle ways. You saw the blood on Centauri's hand. He didn't have to look all torn up. It was just that much, and Robert Preston's performance that sold you on the fact that something happened, something devastating like this happened.
Oh, I mean, it's just chaos right now, everywhere, all around.
In some ways, when you're going to do, like, say, a modern translation of this, as much as I love... Oh, look at Greg's expression. Is that concern or is that anger?
You know, you have to wonder. I think his attitude changes when he sees Centauri.
Yeah. You know what would be interesting would be a backstory on Greg and Centauri. I do think that these two characters have a lot of history together. And it's very well possible that Centauri himself recruited Greg for the Star League. And maybe at one point in time when Greg was younger, because we always feel that he's trending older, maybe Greg was a starfighter. And then when he lost the reflex when he was younger, you know, as he got older, you know, he was a starfighter, but now he serves better as a navigator because he knows Gunstars.
And, you know, you have to wonder if that is what the, if that is how a starfighter actually starts out as the gunner and then eventually becomes a navigator, which I think would be an awesome backstory to see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's, wouldn't you?
It's always a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah. I mean, gosh. The old friend. Like they've chewed up some dirt together in the Star
Wars. Oh yeah.
And I think that's one of the great things about this movie is that there's such emotional weight and impact with these characters. We've only seen them for brief moments, but you believe who they are. And especially like a Robert Preston, he sells the character so much that maybe the 10 minutes total of screen time that he's been given, you care that much.
Oh yeah. I mean, all the characters you just fall in love with, because I think, you know, in some ways you can relate to a little bit of all of them, you know, like what you said with Otis, you know, he was the first mentor and now Centauri is the second mentor to Alex. And now, you know, he's lost one.
Right. And in some cases, it's almost akin to when Frodo loses Gandalf in the Balrog's lair on the bridge of Khazad-dûm. Forgive me, look. Khazad-dûm. I know. On the bridge of Khazad-dûm. You know, there are moments where the hero is stripped of his support, where the only thing left for him are the lessons that he's learned and the belief in himself. And this is one of those moments. I think that's what's great about this movie is that even though you're telling this in a modern way with modern characters, the base realization of the protagonist is that all that I have learned comes down and is crystallized in one singular moment or moments. And then losing a mentor is that I don't have him to rely on anymore. You know, Centauri has got me this far and I count on him, but I can't anymore.
And you know, you have to wonder, because I know we probably all have felt that way where we no longer have that mentor or someone to look up to and they're all gone. And now, you know, you're on your own. It's like, you're no longer in training. So that's it, you know? And even like right here, you know, they're suiting up. He's first time having the Star League pilot outfit or gunner outfit.
I wonder what happened to all these props.
Ah, you know, that's a good question.
Okay, so this is what I call the falling in love sequence. Now, I'm just going to say this really quickly just so that we can make sure that we capture that. What happened with the beta unit in Lewis, that was additional footage just to give Lance Guest, was his beta unit was so well received that they wanted to give him a little bit more footage. So going back to this scene, this is where you're seeing more world building, because when you played Starfighter, you thought it was just a starship. You know, you just thought it was just a fighter, guns, engines. But now you're seeing the true dynamic of what's happening with the Gunstar. The Gunstar is a massively large ship. It's not like an X-Wing fighter or a TIE fighter. This is something that is new, which I think is brilliant. The gangway and the way that Nick Castle directs this, it gives you such great perspective of how actually large this ship really is and how hardy the ship is. You know, it's not just a little snub fighter. It's more like a Y-wing, I think.
Oh yeah. I mean, have you ever noticed though, how much a Star Fury reminds you of a Gunstar?
You're my favorite person in the world right now. You said Star Fury. And yes.
And how cool is it? You see Alex, but when he's looking forward, he sees the HUD.
Right.
Or the heads-up display.
Right.
Ah, don't touch it.
Well, particle beams. Yep. Don't touch that. Of course it is.
You know, I have to say the special effects are still pretty good.
You know, the thing is that design work is design work. You know, it's like you're either going to accept the fact that you've gone in this direction or you're not. Not everything has to be, you know, overdone.
Yeah.
Love this. I love this line. Death is a primitive concept. In another dimension. Oh, my God. So metaphysically awesome, right?
How many others are left? One.
Oh my gosh. That's interesting, awesome. But this is kind of like the Viper launch tube on a Galactica.
Oh yeah.
Oh, so gorgeous. Gunstar is so gorgeous. Oh, I love that ship so much. I'm sorry, folks. I'm gonna go like straight up like ridiculous insanity giddy because I love that ship so much. Grayson, tell me you don't love that ship.
Oh, it's amazing. And I love the fact that the gunner seat can actually just move around 360.
Yeah. Talk about heroic. But it also means that, like, what they're describing here is that the Gunstars, remember, if the Star League was at full strength, the Codan Armada wouldn't stand a chance. And Zor knew that, and Grig knew, Commander Krill, he knew that, Commander Krill. So they had to be able to, they had to use, you know, subterfuge and guile to be able to get past the Star League's defenses with the mass driver to be able to take out as much of the Gunstars as they could. Because when you think about it, what Alex is doing right now and the power that he has in one Gunstar. Imagine a fleet of Gunstars. No way. There's no way the Codan Armada could assault the Star League's influence, their Star Command range, if you will.
I love how he takes off the gloves and he says, there's no way this gung-ho iguana is going to tell me what to do.
Interstellar! I love it. Well, the great thing about this scene is that you are allowing Alex to flex his knowledge of the game. It's a little bit different because obviously when he was playing the video game, he wasn't in a 360-degree floating chair position. So there is a little bit of learning curve, but it's so funny when he pulls his gauntlets off, it's like, you know what? I got to get back to basics. You know, it's almost as if earlier on he needed to show a scene where he cracked his knuckles and kind of flexed his hands. That's like kind of like his go time move, you know?
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking. All right. So we see the beta unit doing what Alex would normally do every day.
And you know it's a beta unit because he combs his hair strangely.
Yes. Didn't know if anyone else would catch on to that one right there.
She's so cute.
She is adorable.
Adorable.
And I don't, did she do much after this movie?
Not that I know of. And, you know, I'm sure the fans, we can all do the whole Google Oracle thing,
but yeah.
Even if she did, or if she did, it's kind of like Elizabeth Shue. I know that Elizabeth Shue, like, you know, she was Academy Award nominee for, I'm not sure if she won for Leaving Las Vegas with Nicolas Cage, but for me, she'll always be Allie from Karate Kid, because that's the movie where she was very much like this character, where no matter what, she always kind of stood by her very, like, almost fatally flawed protagonist, you know, in that case with Daniel LaRusso or Ralph Macchio. But I think this is where we really see how talented Lance Guest really is, because his comedic timing as Beta is amazing.
All right, so now we're back on the Gunstar, seeing with Alex. And then we see him talking about how many squads there are and the command. It's just like the video game right there.
Yep. The great thing about what we're watching right now, these kind of like these exploded layers of the heads-up display, it's not that you need to kind of like make this that much more spectacular if you had to do this today. It's almost as if I'm afraid to see this translated today because it would be maybe overdone. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right, because I mean, even this is just, it's cool. I mean, you see them actually fighting right now, looking for, I think it was the drone ship. So, I mean, it's just the special effects are really cool on this movie. I mean, there's just no two cents about it. So
those evasive maneuvers are pretty impressive. That's all I gotta say.
At least he didn't list lazily to the left.
Well, the Gunstar is a tank. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's very heavily armored. I'm not sure if it has like the greatest maneuverability, but I don't think it needs to because it's so strong. I mean, it's so solid looking. Ugh. Folks, if you're watching this, I mean, really, kind of like take a look at the computer effects and think about, remember, this is 1984. This is like 32 years old. 32 years.
It makes me feel old, doesn't it?
But it still works.
Yeah, it does.
Right?
Absolutely. It works. And it works really well. I mean, just being mesmerized by watching the Gunstar's movement and everything. You know, I mean, I know you've seen the new updated version of Battlestar Galactica, and one of the things I did love about what they did is have the Vipers have the engines on the side so it looks like they're moving much easier in space.
Well, sure. I mean, it has its lateral thruster control, and I think that's something that this is the moment. Sorry, folks. This is the moment Alex has to choose for the very first time to take a life. I mean, think about that. You know, before everything was, it was that moment where it's like, yeah, it's all well and good. We're playing games, but now someone else on the other side, I just killed somebody. And I had to.
And you know, Greg did it on purpose to see if there was a starfighter left.
This is that moment in Joseph Campbell's understanding, like the mythology of a hero, where we literally are in that labyrinthian example of where a hero needs to emerge. He's in the darkness. He's in his own darkness. He literally is in that. One of the my most favorite scenes in any movie is Empire Strikes Back in Yoda's cave. Because when Yoda said, what's in there? What is inside that cave? And Yoda said, only what you bring with you. When Luke strapped on his weapons belt, I thought that that's what he meant. But in this case, it's fear, self-doubt. You know, all of these questions that you bring in with you, those are the things that Alex is really weighing at this moment. Now, in terms of comedic relief, you have to have this moment because without the beta unit influence here and without Maggie understanding what's going on or will understand what is going to happen, you don't get that. I'm trying to dance around something that right now I want to say, but I can't say it because I don't want to jump too far ahead. You know what I'm saying, Grayson? I mean, Davis. I keep calling you Grayson. It's like Davis.
It's all right. Yeah, I exactly. Because, I mean, even with this scene right there, they're in the truck and they're in the back of the truck and they're just wondering, what would you be doing right now if I were you? And you know, the scene where he just starts laughing uncontrollably, which I find hilarious because you're just wondering how does no one else see that something's wrong with him?
Right. Now, it's very well possible that his friends are quote unquote there, but not really there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think we've all had those type of friends where they're just going, yeah, we're just hanging out with you because we like your girlfriend.
Right, exactly. They like Maggie. They're not there because of you. They're there because of Maggie. Zando Zans, they don't fool around.
No, they don't.
And I love how they were called hit beasts. Not hitmen, hit beasts. This is a great moment. Caves that go nowhere.
And reminded him of his home.
Mm-hmm. 6,000 children, which I'm sure to him was probably a small family.
Oh, absolutely.
I love this. I think we actually talked about this in the documentary, in the retrospective, where this is that moment where Greg says, I'm doing this because I'm a father and I'm trying to protect my family from the Codan Armada.
And you know, it's really cool seeing Alex actually sharing his family and telling him about it. We live in a mobile home and it's a cave that goes places. But I think this is that point where Alex finally sees, I have to defend my family as well. Mm-hmm. And it's the turning point.
This is that moment where the hero crystallizes the reason why he is who he is. He understands his talent. He understands his destiny. He understands the motivation. He understands what his mentors were telling him all this time. There's something that, like this moment, he knows that I have been given this opportunity for a reason. When he was in Starfighter Command, when Centauri brought him there for the first time, yes, it was a little overwhelming and off-putting and unsettling. But now, in this labyrinth, in this singular moment, I love that. Oh, so good. Greg's guilt trip. But what I'm saying is that there's that moment where a hero understands that this is my destiny. This is why I'm here. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, even at this moment, he's proven himself. He's proven what he can actually do. he comes blasting out of the caves themselves.
It's the Crucible moment. You know, it's where fire forges the temperament of the hero. And he has the skills. He wouldn't have passed the Excalibur tests of the Starfighter game if he didn't have these skills. It's not so much that, I mean, he has the reflex action. He knows what he's supposed to do. It's all mechanical. It's all muscle memory. What he has to battle with right now is his own conscience. Am I doing the right thing? Is this my destiny?
I love that line. Maybe there is a starfighter left.
God, I'm going to cry. Jesus, this movie is killing me. I say that theatrically, but in my heart of hearts, this is that moment where when we're watching this, this is 1984. My 12-year-old self is really imprinting hard on this movie because when we're, especially the genre that we love, this is where we want to be, where Alex is sitting right now. You know, we know that, like, Star Wars took place in a galaxy far, far away. It's hard for us to kind of get into that moment. But this, it happened on Earth. He was taken away from Earth to be this starfighter. Okay, so that's, I can go for hours and hours and hours on that, but.
And you know what? It's quite all right with that. Was this one of the extra scenes to the movie where he's like, can I put my tongue in your ear now?
I think so. I haven't seen the documentary and the behind the scenes in a while, but I do know that because his beta unit tested so well and because it did so well with the producers and with Nick Castle, it's just, he was so good at comedy. Like Lance Guest was so naturally good at comedy, and the beta unit, I think, needed to be just to have this moment because there's going to be a realization that happens pretty soon. And it's literally one of my all-time favorite moments in film ever. And I'll explain that when it happens, but I love the fact that it's, she's having her fish out of water moment now.
I love that part right there.
Her smile can launch 1,000 gun stars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And she's like, what?
I think that her relationship with Alex is very pure. You know, it's very honest. And she loves what he... Oh, watch out, Zandozan. What? Oh. See?
Now imagine Maggie feeling like that right now.
Yep. You know, one of the interesting criticisms about the movie is that when these things happen, like this issue with the beta unit, it's just, I can accept it.
Yeah, you know what? I can too, because it's just one of those, it's just happening right now. It just flows with the story really well. I mean, I think if they would have, you know, taking any time to do an exposition or anything, it just would not have flown as well as it did.
Right. It's, I think that we have to suspend disbelief a little bit, because I think in today's day and age where there'd be far higher levels of cynicism that was going on, it's like, you know, what is this all about? You got to explain it all to me. But in 1984, it was kind of, you have to roll with it. It just moves forward. And that's kind of like the sentiment of the time.
So they're about to break through. They're about to invade.
It's because those self-stealing stem bolts were terrible.
That's exactly what it reminds me of.
Exactly, right? I mean, yeah. That's how DS9 defended themselves against the Jem'Hadar invasion.
Yeah.
So here it is. This is the moment. This is the moment when the hero decides. I mean, think about it. Like, metaphysically, metaphorically, everything. It's as dark as it possibly could be. There's actually a really interesting line in Buffy the Vampire Slayer season 2 when Buffy was about to go up against Angel. He's like, you have no friends, you have no weapons, you have no support. What's left? Same thing with Alex. His Gunstar is powered down. He has, what does he have left? Maggie's not here. His mother's not here. Lewis isn't here. His family isn't here. This is the moment. And this is my favorite moment of the movie. Not right here, but I mentioned this in the documentary before. What the great thing about this, the editing of this scene is that you have the Codan Armada ready to break through the frontier. You have Alex ready to make his decision. You have Maggie kind of caught up in the whole thrust of the emotion of what's happening. And there's that point in time where space and time collapse to this one very singular human moment.
You owe me one, Alex.
Love it.
You know, it's just really cool because you're seeing what was happening on Earth, and you see what was happening in the command ship, and then you see the message, and all he says is, the last starfighter.
And you know, in movies today, sometimes they kind of like force the entry of the movie title, but this here is very natural insertion of that. But everything that built up to this moment, they all cascade, every single event, one on top of the other. And it just makes your heart swell when you see these events kind of just congeal like this. Remember at the very beginning of the movie when we saw everyone around in Starlight Starbright saying, command ship, what's the command ship? That's the command ship. Even Alex is like, this is the command ship. This is it. This is my destiny. And it's happening right now. That only happened like 45 minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know, and this is it. This is the moment that ties it all together. This is the most human moment of the movie. And it makes me, God, it makes me tear up. He's connecting. I love you, Alex Rogan. She's literally saying that, and he's seeing it and feeling it across the cosmos. And that's what gives him that drive. Remember, she was right by him when he fought the command ship on the stand-up game. That's what gave him the ability to do that. And when she says that, she looks up at the stars. She is sending all of that across space to him. And he looks at her picture at that very same moment. It's that's the most beautiful moment in the movie I've ever seen. It just kills me. It kills me.
Oh. So the last starfighter is dead.
Yeah, I've had enough of you, sir, you pompous ass. Sure.
It's like the friend of the enemy of my enemy is no longer my friend.
Yeah, watch out. I have a speared scepter.
So is the Codan Armada, the Codan, is that actually the alien species name or?
Yes, that's Commander Krill is of the Codan Empire. You know, so okay. It's kind of like the Klingon Empire, the Romulan Star, right. You know, Star Empire. But you know, here it is. I mean, this is the moment. This is what Alex was. It's that Top Gun moment, even though it came before Top Gun. You know, it's like, you know, this is what you were trained for. Look at that! Fire the missiles. Yep, cross pattern. This is the Death Star moment. You know, Luke, trust your feelings. And here is that one moment where if you wanted to capitalize on a sequel, it could have happened. I always had this, because of the Wrath of Khan, I always had the last starfighter, the Wrath of Zur.
And you know what? I don't know why a sequel was never made, because it did pretty well in the box office, like we talked about in the retrospective. I mean, according to the Times, I mean, it should have made a sequel to it. I mean, I don't know what happened.
I don't know. You know, maybe it's just one of those things where the creators, you know, maybe just didn't want to go that direction with this. I don't know. It's strange.
Of course, you know, we have been since what, 2006 maybe? We have been filtered with a lot of sequels in our society for a very long time.
Yeah, I know. And one of the things, Death Blossom panel. Oh, God. So gorgeous. So gorgeous. This reminds me of that scene in the motion picture where Kirk is surveying the Enterprise for the first time, that 13-minute sequence.
Yes.
I love when he's repeating. Yep. This is it. Here we go. Oh, so gorgeous. It's so gorgeous. Like, I don't care if the CGI is this old. Look at the way that the live action explosions just worked seamlessly with the movie and the way that they superimpose that. The Kodan line breaks, and this is it. You're watching what he was playing literally at the very beginning of the movie. You know, his particle beams and his photon bolts. It's all at his command right now. These are the high levels. I mean, that's the arcade culture. You know, that's what the writer was talking about. Imagine if you were playing like a live action version of Joust or a live action version of Frontline or a live action version of Tron or Discs of Tron. This is it. This is, I hate to steal a line from Top Gun, but that's what Viper said. It's like, you know, this is what you were trained for.
Yeah, exactly. So we're about to see almost in range.
Mm-hmm. And the Gunstar can take a beating. You know, it's not like it's, you know, three credits and, you know, put in 25 more cents. Genius. Absolute genius.
And, you know, have we ever seen anything else like that in any other sci-fi adventure?
Not that I've seen. You know, not to this effect. I mean, you obviously had the Death Star super laser and you had like, you know, the snub fighters like the Vipers and the TIE fighters and the X-Wing fighters and even Y-Wing fighters to some extent. But this is that moment where like, you know what is going to make this fighter unique? What is going to make this memorable? And I think that everyone in our generation remembers the Death Blossom, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only other thing I could think of that would maybe come close is the Defiant. I mean, when we first see that in action and you just see that pulsating phasers and torpedoes, I mean, that is an incredible weapon, so to speak, but nothing as significant as a Death Blossom.
Grig is literally Scotty right now. Right? I think that I'm not going to fault any movie for just borrowing a little bit from other fandoms because, you know, Scotty is, you know, he's engineer, he's navigator, he's mentor. He has all these great qualities. And I think it was kind of like part and parcel of kind of like these two-man crews. I mean, like in 1985, we have Top Gun and Goose is Maverick's conscious. I think that every hero, like an Alex Rogan, like a Maverick, like a Luke Skywalker, you have to have that conscience. I mean, even R2-D2 for being like a non-sentient astromech being, he is a little bit of Luke's conscience. You know, he's like, at least he's asking the questions like, is this what you want to do? Is this the right thing to do? And we're coming up on, Davis, tell me I'm wrong. We're coming up on literally the most badass line of any character ever in history.
Oh yeah. I don't think anyone else could ever top this one.
I'm not even going to talk over this.
I do love how the monocle just automatically just covers his eye.
What I love about that is that the Kodan, almost kind of like the Klingon Empire, they're very matter of fact. It's like, what do? We die. We screwed up. We failed. And that was kind of like the whole, you know, that Death Star moment, you know, when like the Falcon and the two fighters, like they kind of like pull away.
Yeah.
I almost wish that there was more time to celebrate that, but we're back at Starfighter Command or Star League Command on Rylos. Obviously, that kind of like at the end of A New Hope, you know, there was more celebration. But Alex is the last starfighter. He literally is the most experienced fighter in the Legion. And this is a great payoff.
He die and miss all the excitement?
Yeah. I thought you were dead.
Dead?
No.
And did you notice when you actually saw the rest of Rylos, it is a huge metropolis city.
Huge. Yeah. Stop thinking human. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, the great thing is about this advice is like you had the sage-like advice in the second, like lesson number two, car salesman advice. This is a great thing. Don't blow it, you know?
Exactly.
I love it so much. Gosh, it's such a great follow-up to such a tremendous scene, you know, with the end of the Codan Armada. This is the choice.
And he stays.
But with conditions.
Yes.
You know, what's great about this moment is that Alex finally understands his place in the universe. However, because of that scene where when Maggie looks up at the skies and says, I love you, Alex Rogan. And at that very same moment, Alex looks at the picture of his family, but focuses on Maggie. You know that there's something that has still been left unfulfilled.
Yeah, it's absolutely, you have to wonder if with the way they planned everything out, it's just, you know, there's still a little bit left to actually finish out the story.
Yeah. You know what's funny is that, and, you know, as much as I like the actress who plays Alex's mom, I always kind of like default myself to Bonnie Bedelia from Die Hard.
Mm-hmm.
She has that same kind of quality, that kind of feel. But this was it. This was, I mean, think about it coming full circle. And that's exactly how we would feel. Lewis is saying exactly how we would feel. At the very beginning of the movie, you're dealing with this dusty, rotting, going nowhere trailer park where people are kind of like just living out their menial existence, like that menial life. And all of a sudden, life imitates art, and the art was the video game. And now the Gunstar itself is here, is a real element in this reality. Look at Otis. Otis like, what the hell?
Hang on a second.
And believe me, if they remade this movie, they would probably cast Sam Jackson as Otis. Which I don't have a problem with, but that would probably happen.
Not Morgan Freeman?
I don't think so, because I think Otis has that Morgan Freeman, like, I don't think that Otis is that statuesque as a character. He just loves throwing in those kind of like those sound bites. But what I love about this is that walking up that staircase is the same shot where people were kind of rank and file to try and get to Alex, who was playing the Starfighter game. There's so much mirroring going on with the foreshadowing that happened at the beginning of the movie and what the reality is now. I love this movie so much. Damn it.
And just that realization where she's thinking, please God, let this be Alex.
Yeah. And I love the fact they fogged up his mask. Like, you know, you're trying to build that suspense. Like, who is this?
And, you know, I think this is actually the tone of a lot of movies during the 80s. Wouldn't you agree? Just, you have a happy ending, you have a reuniting, and it feels so good.
It wasn't a full embrace. She's like, what's going on here? Yeah, there it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Look at Granny. Hey, everybody. I love how honest, you know, this scene is really, and just how pure it is. Like, everybody's having their own reaction. Like, what is going on?
It's like, I don't understand this.
Like, I don't get it. And even Alex doesn't have like the, he only has like the layman's expression. He doesn't have like the, yeah, I've been to another planet. You know, he doesn't have the quote unquote Star Trek techno babble expression. Like, you're supposed to get that, right? It's a beta unit, right?
Yeah.
And look at Blake. Blake's like, oh, whatever, right?
And now they get to meet Grig. Don't you just love Granny's got the shotgun waiting to shoot him?
The former Talosian keeper. Hello.
How do you do?
I do well. I do well. How do you do? Any friend of Alex? Well, he's kind of like, oh, I love this. Oh, he's so great. I love Otis. Look at this.
So Will Wheaton's not in this scene, is he?
No, he's not.
Ah.
He should be like, he could be right there standing, but you know, he's so racked out of focus that we won't be able to know.
Yeah, that's true.
What I love about all these introductions is that they're so genuine.
Yeah.
You know, there's no pomp, there's no circumstance. It's just, it just is.
And you know, you ever notice too that when Grig tells everyone, Alex just saved hundreds of planets and Earth. And no one goes, what? Are you kidding? It's just like, really? He did this? That's amazing.
I love,
you know, everyone took him for, you know, took him for real.
I love Blake's expression. He's like, I could have done that. Like, whatever. But this is the moment. This is that moment that Otis was talking about. When, you know, when you have that opportunity, you grab on with both hands and hold on tight. And this Absolutely. Is Maggie's moment now. Alex has already embraced his moment. This is Maggie's moment.
And now he's even quoting Otis.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
And you know, you have to wonder sometimes if it's a play on even how real life is. You know, someone has had that moment and they're wanting someone else to join them. Mm-hmm. And they're having that self-doubt with them as well. And he has to, you know, let them realize saying, this is it. Let's do this.
This is very much like Alex has already accepted his destiny. He's going to rebuild the Starfighter League. He's going to rebuild Starfighter Command. He's already embraced his destiny. It's interesting that the tonal shift and the narrative shift here is now on Maggie. It's like Maggie is now in that position where Alex was. And he's like, I can't do this without you. I came back here for you.
And you know, he's willing to leave her behind because he loves her that much.
But he also knows that his destiny is larger than this. It's larger than her.
Yeah.
But is her destiny larger than where she is leaving herself? And that's where Alex was at the very beginning. He's like, you know, like, I could have gone to the beach, but no, I got to fix, you know, an antenna.
And then we see it.
Mm-hmm. I almost feel like, you know, there's this Robert Duncan McNeil, Courtney Cox moment from Masters of the Universe happening right now. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, that is such a great movie.
Right? I had to bring that up because they were as fresh-faced as these two were in that moment.
Yeah, they were.
You know, when they held that jewel and it's like, you know, we were there. That was Eternia. Really? Packs a punch? I love Otis so much. Oh, my God.
But you know, you got to wonder, where is she going to be sitting inside the Gunstar?
That's a good question. Maybe a third chair there. Or I don't know. Does the Gunstar, like, you know what? I don't want to be like that fan, but you know, I don't, It's like, does the Gunstar have, you know, FTL? Does it have warp capability? How does it, you know, move through time and space?
Don't worry about it.
Starlight, Starbright, with a place where Alex and Maggie left for the stars.
And now we see the video game. Lewis is right there. And then the Gunstar takes off.
Yep. Everything has come full circle.
Yeah.
It really has. I love his expression. That, wow! Like, that's how I'm feeling right now. Like, literally 32 years to the day that I saw this movie. And that's, and I love how it's going past the Starlight, Starbright sign. You know, it's, oh, Nick Castle, you're a genius in this movie. For God's sake. Oh,
absolutely. And you know, it set up such opportunities to have a sequel. I mean, right there, you see Lewis jumping on the game.
Yep.
You're thinking he could grow up to become another Alex.
Right.
Or, you know, Xur actually escapes. What happens then?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, like right now, they had to only be there for a short time because they would be picked up. And they had to actually, so you know, there's still conflict going on. So I really wish there would have been a sequel to this movie.
And I think we made some really good arguments, debates about it in the retrospective. And we are so far past, we are 3 decades plus past this movie. How do we bring in a new audience to this story? Because first and foremost, this is the end of the movie and now we're in the credits. And thank you, everyone. Thank you, all the listeners, for staying with us this long. We hope that you have appreciated what we have brought to you in our commentary and in our narrative. As you can tell, Davis and I are both emphatically passionate fans about this movie. I have to be completely honest with you. There were times where I had to hold back some emotion because of what this movie brings out in me. And in Davis, I'm sure that I can tell, like, sometimes the smile on your face or sometimes the face of concern, it also brought out emotions in you too.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I'm watching Norm as well. And I know he's smiling at this one point. And, you know, you could almost tell it's a very emotional point that you realize this is an amazing movie.
I think for people that are our age, you know, when you're in 19, so you're 1984, I was 12 years old. How old were you, Grace, Davis?
I was 1984. I was 9 years old.
Okay. So we're in within that, you know, plus five, minus five range, mm-hmm. you know, where we lived the arcade experience. This was our wheelhouse. You know, we would beg our parents to like pay for us to come to these movies. We would love these movies when we saw them in previews on the movie theaters. These are those movies that forged our childhood. And I think that when you see a movie that's going to be coming out soon called Ready Player One, which is the adaptation of Ernst Klein's book, there was a very deep and emotionally resonating part of the 1980s that I don't think that truly can be explained. And I know that's not fair to say to millennials, and millennials are part of our listening base, but there was something that was really significant and very unique and almost undescribable about how hard they tried to make things work like this in the 80s, how they tried to sell this. And I think that's, there's something very earnest and honest and very, what's the right word for this? Just very pure about a story like this. What do you think, Davis?
I completely agree. I mean, we're watching the credits and it's so funny because you and I both have seen other stuff, but it said, you know, the video game brought to you by Atari. Mm-hmm. And even at the very end, it said, read the Berkeley book.
Yeah.
You know, it was doing everything it could to talk more about this, but this movie is, it's really a good family movie. I mean, I don't know how you would feel, but I would have my whole entire family watching this movie because it's just a good family movie.
I think that this movie has a lot of true honesty and purity to it. There's, I don't want to sound naive because, you know, like I've been around this, you know, and for a while, and I've seen some of the great movies and I've seen the movies that, you know, they rely on certain cynicisms and certain tropes. But for this movie, I think I did read a, a critique about this by either Ebert or Siskel, when, you know, Siskel and Ebert were around and critiquing movies. And I think Roger Ebert said that this is a pure Star Wars ripoff, but in the best possible way. And I do agree with that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember reading that too, and I thought in my mind going, yeah. And you know, it works. It works in just so many levels because, like you said, it's a pure movie. I mean, it's sincere. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those movies that I think everybody, whether you were born in the 80s, 90s, whenever, it's a movie you really truly can relate to.
I think about what I love about this movie is that even though it has some far-fetching ideas, it's not insulting to the intelligence. It's very fun. It's very wholesome. It harkens back to a time where things were a little bit more innocent. And yes, you are dealing with a protagonist that is very, what's the right word? I wouldn't say optimistic, but he's a dreamer. Alex Rogan is a dreamer. He wants to just go a little bit above his station. And in the midst of this movie, he goes way beyond his station because of a talent that he inherently possesses. And it's not the talent of the video game. It's the talent of caring. He is a very caring individual. That quality about him, caring for the people that he loves, making sure that Maggie is well protected, making sure that his family is defended, that the Earth is protected, that the Star League has champions and people that will defend this notion of right and wrong, right versus wrong. I think that in and of itself is the true quality that Alex Rogan possesses. Not the mechanics of being able to beat a video game, but what is he willing to sacrifice and put himself on the line in order to defend the people that he loves? I think that's a very human quality. I think it's a quality that everyone resonates with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything you just said because it truly is just a honorable movie, so to speak.
Now, before we wrap this up, I just want to ask you a couple questions. One, when we did this commentary and when you were reacting to certain things, what gave you the strongest and most profound emotional reaction as you were watching the story?
Oh, goodness. You know, I have to say probably one of the reactions, the first one was when Alex goes back to Rylos and sees everything in chaos. And then soon after that, his friend, his mentor, passes away. And it's like much like a Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yeah. I know we've been using a lot of Star Wars references in this and everything, but you know, it really is. It's that moment where he realizes, I've lost pretty much everything, and what do I do now? Like, where do I go? You know, how am I going to be? And you know, unlike, you know, can you almost think of it in a real world example where you really have to take that leap of faith from that point? Mm-hmm. What about you?
I thought it would change, but there's a little bit of a tie, but I think I'm still leaning towards the end of the movie where Mags like looks up at the stars and says, I love you, Alex Rogan. It doesn't matter like where she's standing. Like, she's standing on a beach or at least on the side of a highway, you know, where Beta Unit destroyed the communications device of the Zandozan bounty hunter. But when she looks up at the stars and she says, I love you, Alex Rogan, it's like she's sending out like a hailing signal. Wherever you are, this is how I'm feeling right now. And my, you know, one of my all-time favorite moments in the movie is when Otis says, you know, when that moment comes, you got to grab on with both hands and hold on tight. I think that's a sound sentiment for almost any movie. But I just love that she's looking up. She doesn't know where to look, but she's looking up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the marketing pieces for this movie, you know, you have that great iconic illustration of Lance Guest as Alex Rogan. He's standing there. It wasn't a very heroic pose. He's standing there with his flannel shirt, which is very signature, very disheveled, and he has like just hands full of his starfighter uniform, like he did when he was on Rylos for the first time, looking up at the sky. And the expression is this real? What am I doing?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, so I love that, that there's still kind of a very human, tangible reaction to what's happening to him. And I think that's allows the characters to identify with the audience, you know, very much like in every Star Trek series, there's a character that allows you to personify yourself with that particular character's emotional context of the time. And I think that's what happens a lot in this movie, which makes it successful.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. All right. So do you have any final thoughts before we wrap this up for the evening?
You know, it's really difficult to try and summarize how my emotional response to going through a commentary like this, because this movie is so important to me. As everyone knows on social media, you know, I've always used the Starfighter logo as my avatar on all of my social media. I've customized my own jewelry, my own ring to replicate the Star League logo. It's not because it's necessarily my most favorite movie in the world, although it's right up there, but it's probably one of the most meaningful movies to me in terms of what it's saying. And what this movie says to me is that there is the potential of something greater in all of us as long as you recognize the signs and grab on and hold on tight. Whatever your destiny in life may be, don't shy away from those signals that tell you this is your moment. And I think that's why I love this movie so much, because when Alex realizes that these are his moments, becoming the starfighter and becoming that person that Maggie needs, that's when his life crystallizes and takes perfect form. Because he didn't see that at the beginning as much as he had it in front of him. And Otis saw that. That's what I love about Otis. You know, Otis saw that. He saw that Alex has everything in his life that he needs. All he needs to do is recognize it for what it is and make sure that he never loses the grasp on it that he needs to hold on to. And that's what that movie means to me.
I mean, how can you top that right there? I mean, that I just have to say ditto.
Well, and I know it sounds preachy, but when storytelling works at its best, it's about being able to make the human connection, no matter what the genre is, whether it's fantasy or a Western or an action adventure or science fiction. If you don't believe that you can tangibly connect with the characters that you are investing yourselves in for an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes, 2.5 hours, doesn't matter how expensive the movie is, doesn't matter how high quality the production is, if you don't resonate with the characters, then the story is lost. And this is one of those movies that is a quiet movie that becomes epic. But the bottom line is that every single main and even some secondary characters that appear in this movie, you are emotionally invested in. And that is a very, very important quality that I think is lost in a lot of movies today.
And you know, the one thing that we have been talking about that we haven't even mentioned another part of the movie. We've been talking about the characters, the story. But never once did we say how great the special effects were, because it didn't matter.
It didn't matter.
It was the story. The story is what makes this movie so good.
You are 110% right. It's not about... See, and I think that proves the point. I think that proves the fact that if this movie was done in the 1970s, you know, very much like, you know, Your Space 1999, even if it was done in the 1960s, you know, a la Star Trek or a la The Twilight Zone or a la The Outer Limits. You know, it's the characters that you care about. The CGI is just window dressing, very much like Tron. You care about the characters. Yeah. If you don't care about the characters, everything else doesn't matter. You know, even if you had the best special effects of all time, the highest budget of all time, if your characters suffer and aren't fully realized, that movie will fall apart in an instant.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in case anyone's ever wondering, yes, we recommend this movie very highly.
Do we put a rating on this? Davis, what's your rating on a movie like this?
I would have to say 5 out of 5 gun stars.
I would. Yeah, it's hard to put, you know, like an actual cognitive rating on this, but you know, it's like 5 out of 5 gun stars or 100% Death Blossom range, you know, or, you know, 10 out of 10 Camino crystals, whatever the meter may be. I think that you would agree. And I'm taking a huge leap of faith here, but I think that Davis and I are on the same page. This is a movie that is an absolute must movie to watch. Absolute must. And if you have the potential and the ability to watch the Blu-ray version, please watch that and then watch the documentaries and then watch all the additional features, because there is so much more to just the movie. There is that entire cult following that has stayed with this movie to this time, to the point where Rogue Synapse has created their own stand-up, their one, maybe two Rogue Synapse stand-up versions of the game, which Kevin Reitzel, you know, our friend and co-founder here on the Phantom Podcast Network, had the opportunity to play at that arcade convention, which I'm like beyond jealous of because I love arcades. So it's, tell me I'm wrong. I don't think I am.
No, you are absolutely correct. And in case anyone wanted to know about the Blu-ray, some of the extra features, one of the commentaries is from director Nick Castle and production designer Ron Cobb. So in case you don't want to listen to us, you always have that opportunity to listen to them. And they might have a little bit more insight, but just a little bit more.
So as we wrap this up, Davis, because we literally could talk about this movie like ad infinitum.
Oh, yes.
So what do we have coming up here on the Phantom Podcast Network? Because we are wrapping up this is our second part actually of the Last Starfighter retrospective on the Couch Potato Theater show. But we do have a fair amount of great content that is coming your way here on the Phantom Podcast Network. So what do we have coming up?
For Blood of Kings, I know we have been talking about many different Highlanders, but I know that there is a convention that you're going to be heading to. And I know I can actually almost officially say 90% sure that I will be heading to a Highlander convention in December.
So yeah, at the end of October, and the newly minted, renamed Kamikaze, which is now the Stan Lee Los Angeles Comic Convention, and it was the last name of the 7-Eleven owner in The Simpsons. I don't remember his last name, though. But that's the new official long and kind of convoluted new title for Kamikaze. Anyway, I will be there representing the Phantom Podcast Network and Blood of Kings for the Sword Experience that is hosted by Adrian Paul of Highlander fame. And that will be a really fun convention to be at. And we will have a Phantom Podcast Network /Blood of Kings meetup there. So that's going to be a lot of fun. That's going to happen on October 29th. And then, yes, on December 3rd through 4th this year, it's going to be the Highlander 30th anniversary LashCon convention, where we have guests, and this is very impressive, a guest list that's starring Christopher Lambert of the original 1986 movie Connor McLeod and Adrian Paul and Duncan McLeod of the TV series. You're going to have Elizabeth Grayson there. You're going to have F. Bron McAsh, who was the Swordmaster there. You're going to have Ken Gord there, who is the executive producer. You're going to have a whole cavalcade of different entertainers from the 30th anniversary.
John Mosby.
Yeah, that's right. Mosby.
John Mosby.
Yes, he is going to be the I believe he's going to be the maitre d' there, or the master of the circus. And he also is the author of the unofficial guide to Highlander called Fearful Symmetry. So yes, John Mosby is going to be there. And there are going to be other celebrities there as well. And there are going to be some really interesting panels that you can participate in. The Sword Experience that is sponsored by Adrian Paul's Sword Experience. And you're going to have the, I believe it is a Tai Chi fan exhibit demonstration by Elizabeth Grayson, who is also going to be there. I didn't say Elizabeth Grayson. And F. Bron McAsh is going to do a combat knife technique course. So, gosh, there's so much stuff going on there. And I'm not going to be there. Awesome.
I know. And I know Kyle and Kevin have been working on Culture Clash, and I don't know if you've been listening to it or not, but they actually have a new segment where they introduce podcasts that they listen to. And just recently, they did one on Cloud City. Oh, I feel so terrible. It was Cloud City.
No, it was Skywalking Through Neverland.
Well, Skywalking Through Neverland, but there was one that just released. Cloud City.
Casino?
Casino, that's it. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, very cool, and makes me, you know, if you haven't had a chance to check that out, definitely look at Skywalking Through Neverland and check out Cloud City Casino, and, you know, you might even start enjoying listening to them as well. So, and I know you're a pretty big football fan.
I can hold my own with football, even though my fantasy team is terrible right now, but yeah.
Yeah, I know Kyle and Kevin have actually been doing the End Zone, which has been doing a fantasy football weekly. I think they're on week two or week three right now.
Week three right now, as we're recording the show, week three. Yep.
Yeah, very, very cool. Mm-hmm. So, and I know Couch Potato Theater will be coming back. We have a myriad of cultural movies that we would love to actually go over. Some we'll probably just do a retrospect, and I think a couple we might just do documentary.
Well, we have a lot. I mean, there are so many in this format, because the reason why we started this particular show is because there are those movies where, you know, you're lying on your couch and you just can't not shy away from. So, just to give you a couple of examples of where we are at in our mindset, you know, we have movies like, you know, the seminal classic of the 1980s, Krull, and you have Big Trouble in Little China, you have Flash Gordon, you have Heavy Metal. So these are the kind of movies. I mean, we had Transformers, we did Megaforce, and now we're finishing up The Last Starfighter. So there is a certain quality to these movies that we love. These aren't necessarily the biggest blockbusters of the time, but these are the movies that we fell in love with when we were of age coming up in the 80s. And oh, I'm sorry. I said 90s because, speaking of the 90s, you know, we have the Phantom Flashback. It has nothing to do with the 90s, but it has something to do with the late 80s, 1986. So as you can tell by our choice of genres, we are all very well steeped in the 1980s.
Absolutely. And I know Norm is very much looking forward to doing the retrospective of the 80s about Iron Eagle, which came out in 1986 too.
Jason Gedrick, Lou Gossett Jr., and a thigh-strapped Walkman. How can it get better than that, right?
Give me some 11.
And the Ruskies, because who doesn't like fighting against the MiGs and those Ruskies?
Oh, that was an epic movie, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right, Norm, well, what can they reach you at if they want to get in contact with you on Twitter or Facebook?
You can always find me on Blood of Kings. That's the Highlander fandom podcast page on Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at Starfighter1701. That is the same handle that I use on Instagram. And then you can find me also on Facebook as Norman Lau.
And you can also find me on Twitter at Davis Grayson, or you can also find me on Facebook at Davis Grayson, and you can find me in the Phantom Podcast Network, or you can even find me in a myriad of other places, from the G.I. Joe discussion board to Trek FM's Babel Conference. And you can also contact us at the Phantom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. We have a Facebook, like we said, a Fandom Podcast Network. Email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We're also on the Twitter at Fandom Pod Network. Kyle, who is also one of the original founding members.
FanPodNet.
FanPodNet. Yeah, so sorry.
So it's FanPod Network on Twitter.
Yes. Yeah. And Kyle can be found at AKyleW, and Kevin on Twitter can be found at @Spartan_Phoenix.
One of these days, we're actually going to get to Demolition Man, because I think that Kevin would just, obviously he would own that show, being Spartan_Phoenix.
Oh, absolutely. I think we would just let him handle the ball.
I think so. Yeah. Or the three seashells.
Indeed. Indeed. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening to us tonight, and Norm, you have any final words to say?
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! That's all I have to say. Sorry.
Interstellar. All right. Everyone, Thank you for listening to us, and have a great night.